Good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here this morning. Our briefs and the recent supplemental submissions, I respectfully submit, distill down the issues that remain here. They are, I submit, that the whether or not the conduct was immoral and therefore hostile to Mr. Leto's ability to teach, and secondly, whether or not there is evidence in the record below to support the above two contentions. Obviously, but for his position as a teacher, this conduct would not be considered immoral. If he had been a policeman or a fireman, we would not be here. We are here because he was a teacher. The fact remains, as the reviewing court stated at page 4 of its opinion, that the context of the academic or school setting is the controlling factor. It doesn't necessarily jive with the decision of the school board, wherein at page 5 of the appendix they stated that is the district's position that even though Mr. Leto did not have a teacher-student relationship with the student at the time of the sexual relationship, the relationship was clearly improper because it was a reinitiation of the relationship with the former student that occurred when the former student entered the school environment to pick up her younger sibling, a current student at the school where Mr. Leto was teaching. The second prong, respectfully, that I believe needs to be addressed and wasn't addressed at all below is the whether or not...
When you say below, do you mean in the trial court's opinion?
I mean in both the hearing and the trial court's opinion. And I apologize because both.
Okay.
In both. The first one being whether or not the conduct was hostile to his teaching. Could he still perform as a teacher? At page 5 of the trial... reviewing court's decision.
When you said hostile and could he still perform as a teacher, are those the same thing?
I think in the, like when I looked at the Bertolini cases and those, they used that term hostile. Does it mean that he, his teaching is compromised because of his conduct? And it has to be adverse to that. So that's why I used the term hostile.
Okay, well, is it fair to make a distinction between hostile in the sense that a teacher loses credibility, people lose confidence in the teacher, or are we talking about no longer remembers where Kazakhstan is in relation to Lithuania?
No, the first.
Competency as
yes,
the teacher.
Yes, exactly. Whether they, the community would lose confidence in him, whether or not his conduct is hostile to that type of job description.
Okay.
They're supposed to do. So with regard to that, we look at first what the reviewing court did at page 5 when they talked about the recognition of the relationship by others began probably, inevitably, to occur. That wasn't below. That didn't happen below. Ultimately, it spread to friends and to parents of friends and to police authorities. That's not necessarily what the record below has. The record below says that the young lady in another school district had said something to one of her girlfriends that was on a hockey team. And that girlfriend said, hey, Mom, I think these two people are involved. And that mother then called the police officer. And then the court goes on to say, whether prudish or archaic or representative, this was a community reaction.
Was the fact of the arrest that preceded the hearing before the school board? Is that right?
That's correct.
And, yes. And is there evidence in the record about publicity relating to that? I assume that made the papers.
You know, I would assume, too, but I really, honestly, I can't tell you if it did, and I don't know if it did.
But so there's nothing in the record about it?
There's nothing about that in the record. And that the whole idea is how, whether or not, in our position, whether or not the community, there was evidence that the community was affected, the community of teachers, students in the Caesar Rodney School District. So we respectfully submit that the reviewing judge basically stated things that weren't in the record to support his belief that, at page 8, the community, the teacher must be a person that can be looked up as a mentor and role model, and that this, what he did, does not square with community mores. In the answering brief of the appellee at page 14 of their answering brief.
Is it your position there has to be evidence on that?
It is my position there has to be evidence in the record.
All right, so let's take, just to illustrate the point, a hypothetical of an extreme example, an elementary school teacher who's convicted of a sex crime with a very young child. Would there have to be evidence that that person could no longer teach under that circumstance?
I think there has to be a scintilla of evidence, no, a little more than a scintilla. There has to be some evidence to indicate, even though that's so abhorrent and everything, that that is against the community mores, that he's lost confidence, that it's hostile.
Well, how can something that's a crime not be contrary to community mores?
There are times, I think, when the crimes that we're talking about when in relation to the community of students and everything doesn't rise to the level of the ones that shock our conscience in other ways. I mean, I think stealing candy bars or something like that, even though it's a crime, it might not shock the...
All right, let's put aside something like a DUI or shoplifting or failure to file an income tax return on time that theoretically right. constitutes a crime. One that involves sex with a minor under any circumstances, how does that not constitute immorality?
Well, I mean, I don't believe that was the question that Justice Rizzi asked,
I'm not bound to follow his question.
No, I understand. But the answer is, I think that, respectfully, is immoral right away. On its face, it's immoral.
Then where do we go with it?
Well,
what more is necessary?
Whether or not there is an effective, whether or not the teacher could be effective, whether or not just destroys his credibility.
Let me see if I understand you. You're saying that even if it were undisputed that the conduct was immoral, that would not be enough to justify a discharge?
I don't believe that would be enough under these facts. That's correct. Under these facts, because every case we've seen, every case that Appley and I have submitted to the court are distinguishable on their facts. We are dealing with a 17-year-old consenting individual from another school district. We're not dealing with someone in this teacher's school district. We're not dealing with someone in this teacher's class. We're not dealing with any of the other students that this teacher is in charge of.
You're leaving out two facts, aren't you? Fact number one being that the student with whom the teacher was involved had a younger sibling who was a student in the school where the teacher taught. And secondly, that the 17-year-old minor was being mentored by this teacher.
I did leave those out, and I didn't mean to leave those out. What I meant was that we're not dealing with... In all the other cases that both sides have submitted, there is not this set of facts. This young lady was not in his, I hate to use the term that the police tried to use initially, but that he was not in a position of trust and authority over her.
Well, the cases talk about a connection between the conduct and his position at the school. Why is it unreasonable for a school board to take notice that older siblings frequently bring their younger siblings to school and say, we don't want someone on our faculty who's inclined to strike up romantic relationships with teenagers that are between 16 and 17.
First of all, I think that's exactly what the school board did.
Right. And so my question is, why is that not the connection that we find in the cases that would justify the termination?
Because under this situation, I don't think that rises to the level of just cause that they had to use to get rid of him.
So let's suppose hypothetically the parents are at the hearing with the school board, a group of parents.
Right.
And they say, we feel very uncomfortable having our teenage daughters take their siblings to school while he's on your faculty because he's struck up one relationship and he may strike up a relationship with our child, and we just think that's inappropriate to have him continue on your staff. Now, you're saying the answer should be, well, that's okay. How do you phrase that?
Well, respectfully, Mr. Justice Holland, I wouldn't be here if that were the case of what happened below.
No, I understand. That's why I framed it as a hypothetical. Yeah. But if you're going to respond to a parent's concern that it not happen to their child, how does the school board do that?
I think the school board has to find out what the concern is. They have to take the pulse of the community.
Well, in my hypothetical, you have more than one parent saying, we're uncomfortable. And now you're suggesting that it would be all right for the school board to retain your client, notwithstanding that discomfort.
No,
my question is why?
I apologize. That was my position was once there was some evidence in the record of that discomfort, of that hostility, so to speak, then I believe that rises to the level of just cause of the cases that I have submitted.
Now, the school board's elected from the community that they serve.
They are.
These aren't half a dozen people from Manhattan that come down to look at the case.
That's correct.
Why should we not assume they have some sense of what the community thinks? And if the community disagrees, they don't get reelected.
I think respectfully, because as the appellee says, it was their conscientious judgment that ultimately the board and Leto's conduct would impair his effectiveness as a role model, and I guess that's where you're coming from. I believe because there was nothing whatsoever, not a scintilla of evidence in the record to suggest that, and that these people are superimposing their beliefs. And
I understand where you're going, Mr. Lurie, and if we were reviewing a superior court judge, not elected, not necessarily from the community, perhaps from another county, not that that's a big difference in Delaware, but it's somewhat of a difference, that argument might make a little more sense. But shouldn't we consider the fact that these people are elected by the people in a school district? And shouldn't we assume they have some sense of community thinking when issues like this come up that's different than a cold record before a judge who's not sitting in a quasi-judicial chair?
Is there
a role here entirely judicial, or is it quasi-judicial?
Your Honor, I think it's quasi-judicial, and I think that you can take into consideration that they have been elected by the populace of the Cesar Rodney School District, but I don't think you can make that jump that they speak for the conscience of the Cesar Rodney School District community, because there was nothing other than their supposition. There was nothing in the record to support that. And now we're saying because they're elected that they have a consciousness,
okay. I take your
conscientious
point.
Judgment.
I take your point. Now, in reviewing their thought processes and their findings, given what you just said, what's our standard of review for both them and for Superior Court?
The standard of review is, the lower court stated correctly, it's substantial evidence, and I don't believe
there's... You're saying there's really none. There's not even substantial.
I don't believe that there is that.
All right, so on the, I guess in terms of procedural propriety, you're saying that while it would have been appropriate, that the board would have had a basis to fire this particular teacher if, in fact, they had taken the pulse of the community and gotten the response from the parents that Justice Holland described. They can't do that without having a hearing at which they put some of those parents on the witness stand to testify before the board about those feelings. Is that correct?
That's my
that
position.
Is what this case boils down to is a failure at the board level to make a record by putting one or more parents on the witness stand,
or anyone on the stand, and that is my argument.
Well, what about inferences to be drawn from the facts? Aren't these legitimate inferences?
And my I think the the inference that you're asking me to consider is that because they're elected from the community, then they are taking the pulse of the community?
Actually, the inference I'm asking you to consider is the one, this statement in the apparently the board's decision. While the student was enrolled in the school other than at which Mr. Alito taught, the fact that she was both a former student of Mr. Alito and an older sibling of a current student at the school where Mr. Alito taught threatens the moral and social fabric of the school environment and sends the wrong message to students of the district regarding appropriate relationships between teachers and students. Can't they draw that inference from this evidence?
The evidence, I don't see the evidence, respectfully. It's not. It wasn't there below, and I don't think just because they're school board members, they're allowed to supplement that for evidence that is needed in a hearing for just cause to terminate them.
What about the fact that your client was arrested on the basis of a parent's concern about his conduct? Doesn't that provide an inference that his conduct was not acceptable under community standards?
Respectfully, it wasn't the community that we're talking about. It was a Polytech community parent. We're talking about the Cesar Rodney School District community. It had no impact whatsoever with regard to the Cesar Rodney School District.
Well, Polytech gets students from the Cesar Rodney
from
School
the entire
district.
County.
Yeah,
they can.
So there's
right.
that overlap. It's not as if it's Appaquinimic. True.
That's correct. But the point, I think the dilemma is then, if we're talking about the context being the fact that it was a teacher relationship, does geography really play a role? I think it's the nature of what the evidence was about the community there, that what the Cesar Rodney burden that they had, that community.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I do. I apologize. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the Court, Noel Primos for the Board of Education of the Cesar Rodney School District. One of the questions I think that was apparent in the appellant's argument was the question of was in fact there at least a scintilla or more than a scintilla of evidence of this issue. In other words, did the immorality, and I think there's a consensus that this action was immoral, but did the immorality in question impair Mr. Leto's effectiveness as a teacher? And so the question seems to be, was there a scintilla of evidence that there was some impact on the community? And I would respectfully submit that that has not been the standard that has been used in the cases that have dealt with this issue. In other words, there has not been a requirement that a school board call parents to testify that they would be concerned about certain activity by a teacher.
Well, let's assume that the school board needed some evidence. You know, the way Mr. Liguori characterizes the state of the record, it's almost like the board applied a res ipsa loquitur doctrine, that if we have a teacher, we have a 17-year-old, and the 17-year-old's a former student who renewed a relationship in the context of picking up a younger sibling. As the school board said, we think that's inappropriate. We don't need any more facts. Dismissed. Now, and I'm not suggesting that's right or wrong. I'm trying to understand where you're characterizing the state of the record with regard to evidence. And as I read your brief, you're saying what they had was enough, whether we call it res ipsa loquitur or not. Those were the facts and a justified determination. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. In other words, that it is acceptable for a board to use reasonable inferences that if an older sibling is picking up a younger sibling at school, younger sibling's a student of the teacher and so forth, that there would be this effect. An example is the Skripchuk case. And in that case, the court found that the board had used its conscientious judgment to determine that the conviction of the teacher of certain crimes would impair his effectiveness as a teacher. There was no indication that there was any evidence in the record that it had impaired his evidence or his effectiveness as a teacher past tense. In fact, in
this case, we're focusing on non-criminal conduct, and you know we're always concerned about the implications of any precedent we set. So let's assume hypothetically that the 17-year-old in this case was working at a fast food restaurant, and the teacher went to the fast food restaurant and they got reacquainted, and their relationship evolved, but it evolved exclusively because of the renewal at the fast food restaurant. Under those facts, would the teacher be discharged?
Your Honor, I can say certainly that that is not this case. I can't, Your Honor, it may perhaps be that the school board in its conscientious judgment would determine that if the relationship was totally separate from the school environment, that there would not be a discharge.
But well, I'm trying to help you focus us on what are the determinative facts in this case. And it seems that the school board relied on the fact that the relationship was renewed at the school, and it was renewed in the context of picking up a younger sibling who was a student. And those two facts combined to give the school district concern. And my question is, are those facts case dispositive? You win this appeal. And if they are, help us with the next case where the relationship starts in the fast food restaurant.
Well, Your Honor, I think those two facts are important and some additional facts as well. Not only that the relationship was reinitiated when she came to the school environment, but that there had been a prior relationship. She had been a former student of his at the elementary school.
Going back to my McDonald's question, if you renew a relationship with a former student, it might lead to a discharge. But if this is a 17-year-old you're meeting for the first time at McDonald's, it may not.
It may not, yes, Your Honor. If you have taught a student in elementary school and then you see the student as a 17-year-old working at a fast food restaurant, you reinitiate the relationship. You say, I'd like to help you with the school project. Perhaps that would be.
Well,
but this case is even stronger. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The line that Justice Holland's trying to get you to help us with is a difficult one to draw when you use as a basis a term like immorality, the way in which that has changed over at least my 6 decades of existence. The 17-year-old at McDonald's has, let's say, peers, friends that go to the school where the school teacher teaches. And as things happen, they know about the affair. Where does the line get drawn under that hypothetical?
And, Your Honor, then it could well be that the school board, using its conscientious judgment, and part of that conscientious judgment is determining what the mores of the society are, what the community mores are.
Yeah, but one of the problems with that, which I think Mr. LaGore's responses to my questions about the quasi-judicial nature of school boards is, how are people on notice that certain conduct would threaten their job but other conduct would not? What kind of notice do they get that action would be taken that would cause them to have their job terminated? And on what can they rely that here's the line? If I cross that line, I will be terminated. If I go right up to the line but don't cross it, I will not. Are they not entitled to that kind of notice?
Well, Your Honor, I understand your concern, but it's possible that the teacher in Molstay could have made the same argument. Here was a gentleman who had a relationship with a former student. She was not a current student. He had coached her basketball team, but he was not currently coaching her. He felt, obviously, that the relationship was appropriate. There was no sexual contact at all. There were emails that went back and forth in which he professed his affection for the individual, but no sexual language, at least overtly sexual language. He could have made the same argument. How was I to know that this relationship was inappropriate when there was nothing sexual about it at all? And there is a sense in which the court is drawing lines successively, and there may well be situations where a person would say, how would I know that this conduct is inappropriate because it's never fallen into one of the examples before that's been dealt with by a court? But here, in this case, where you have a teacher reinitiating a relationship with a former elementary school student when she comes into the school environment to pick up her younger sibling. He conducts a mentoring relationship with her, helps her with school projects. That relationship becomes sexual. In this case, I don't think Mr. Leto could use that argument. Well, how would I know that this activity was immoral? How would I know that it violated community mores? And
well, you've had a lot of time to think about this. How would you suggest the school board do its orientation for teachers, whether you put it in writing or you do it in your verbal orientation, and you want to tell them what's not acceptable in the district? How would you phrase it?
Well, I think there would be a general prohibition against inappropriate relationships with students in their school, but there could be an indication of other types of relationships that may occur. As we know, teachers are not confined to their classrooms. So, and many times in many of these cases, the relationships were coaching relationships, not classroom relationships. So there could be an indication that there shall not be inappropriate relationships with students, whether in the classroom or in other settings.
Well, but the rule that you seem to be, the logical extension of the rule you seem to be advocating is clearly you don't have a relationship that's inappropriate with anyone in your school district. But it seems to be that you, at the orientation, would say to the teachers, we don't tolerate our teachers having relationships with any students, irrespective of their age, in any school district, period. So you need to know that if you want to teach in our school district, you're not to get romantically involved with any student anywhere, even if they're 18 years old, because we don't tolerate relationships between teachers and students at all. Is that the effect of what your rule would be?
Well, Your Honor, that might be a rule that could be drawn to prevent the kind of situation here. But even if the school board stepped back and said, you are not to have relationships with students or former students while they are minors, that would cover this situation.
And so are you suggesting in this case the result would have been different if the student was 18 years old and still a student?
Your Honor, I think there would still be the concern about a former student and a mentoring relationship and the school environment. I can't say that the school board in its judgment might not have considered it differently, but I think it was significant to the school board in this case that the individual involved was a minor.
The only real difference between the 18 situation that Justice Holland asked you about is the fact it wouldn't have been a crime.
It wouldn't have been a crime.
Otherwise, you could argue it still had the same deleterious effect on the atmosphere at the school. If the 18-year-olds bring her younger sibling to the school where this teacher is an instructor.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I exactly understand your question.
What is the difference about where you would draw the line between the student who's 18 and dropping off their sibling and a student who's 17 at another school district and dropping off their sibling? Does that make that year difference, that alleged adulthood gives them the right to vote, the right to sign a contract, to buy a car, all the rest of that, supposedly makes them of good judgment, right, when they turn 18 suddenly?
Well, Your Honor, I think your question goes to the difficulty of drawing bright lines and that the school board has to be allowed to use its conscientious judgment to consider all the factors in the case. And in this case, there were numerous factors, including that she was a minor, including that she was a former student, including that the relationship was reinitiated in the school environment when she came to pick up her younger sibling, who was still a student of the teacher, including that it moved from a mentoring relationship to an overtly sexual relationship. All of these factors were considered by the school board. And I would point out that I believe the appellant has argued that the following year this younger sibling was no longer a student at the elementary school. There's nothing in the record that indicates that. There's
Mr.
no
Primos,
evidence in the record that indicates that.
If I understand your position correctly, it's that, number one, you know, desirable as it may be for this court to draw a bright line, you're not able to give us one. But no matter where that bright line is, this case falls beyond it.
Yes, Justice.
That is on the
yes.
wrong side of it. And secondly, that in making that determination, it is not necessary for the school board to bring in parents or other members of the community to make some sort of formal record of the deleterious effect of the teacher's behavior. It's enough that the school board could draw those inferences. That is, that they would be, you know, logically and reasonable inferences. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. And this goes to the fact that a school board is not a court. It is expected to hold a hearing in which there are certain basic procedural requirements met, such as the person is allowed to confront witnesses against him and so forth. But the school board is a group of community members who have been elected and have been tasked, have been entrusted with the task of determining what are the community mores, what is immoral in a community. And
can I try one more hypothetical?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which, again, I don't think any of us are trying to, you know, find inappropriate arrangements and say, well, is this good enough or is that bad enough? But it does occur to me, what if in the exact fact pattern that we have here, before the young woman's friend said something and it became public knowledge and the parent took action, if before any of that happened, the two of them got married, the teacher and the 17-year-old, would that make it not immoral? You know, would that protect him against being dismissed as a teacher?
Well, Your Honor, I believe what was significant here, though, was the relationship that had gone on before that. I don't believe even in that case that the school board would want to encourage a teacher entering into a sexual relationship with a minor former student that is initiated in the school environment, even if ultimately the relationship ends in marriage. So what was significant here was the relationship itself. It did come to light in the way that it did, with a parent, with a student telling a parent and the parent contacting the police. But what was important was the relationship itself. And going back to the Skripchuk case, it's interesting that in that case, while the criminal charges were pending, the student in question, an industrial arts teacher, was named the outstanding industrial arts teacher in the state of Delaware while these criminal charges were pending. And his argument was, this obviously hasn't impaired my effectiveness as a teacher. I can still teach because I was named the outstanding teacher of the year while the charges were pending. And the school board used its conscientious judgment know that it would impair his effectiveness as a teacher. There's no indication that they called parents in and said, what do you think of this teacher who's been convicted of these crimes? There's no indication they conducted a poll. They were allowed by the court to use their conscientious judgment as members of the school board to determine, we believe that this has impaired or would impair his effectiveness as a teacher.
Mr. Primos, isn't the difficulty here one that flows from the fact that the concept of teacher effectiveness really has two aspects? One is as Chief Justice and others have pointed out, the professional competence of the teacher in transmitting information, you know, whether it be art or some other field. That's not an issue here. The other, which is much more amorphous, is the role model aspect.
Yes.
And basically, one person's role model may be different from someone else's. And the problem that that the law has is in trying to establish a standard to deal with that phenomenon in a way that, as the Chief Justice pointed out, persons who are in a position of teaching students, minor students, have notice of what is and what isn't permissible from the job termination standpoint.
Yes, Your Honor, again, that is an important aspect, impairing the teacher's position as a role model or example to his students. And the courts have not required the school board to go and poll parents in the community to determine, do you think this teacher's effectiveness has been impaired?
Of course, we don't know whether in Scripchuck or these other cases the argument was made there that is being advanced here.
Yes,
or,
Your Honor.
Or was it?
Yes, Your Honor, that's not true, but there's no indication in these cases that that was a requirement that was imposed upon the school board to do that. And to keep in mind, Your Honors, that this was a situation where this relationship between Mr. Leto and the student went on from December to May. At some point in the spring, around March or April apparently, it became sexual in nature, but it went on until May. And then it became known as a criminal activity, or the police began to investigate it. But would the school board be expected to allow Mr. Leto to continue as a teacher, to go back into the school environment after all of this had been discovered and say, okay, let's test you out and see if your effectiveness as a teacher has been impaired? Let's see if parents are upset, or students are upset, or anything of that nature. That's not a requirement that should be imposed upon a school board. A school board can make a determination, would your effectiveness be impaired as a teacher, as a role model to students?
I think, Your Honor, I understand your position about the board's exercise of its authority and its accountability through elections and the rest of that, but let's go back to the notice requirement. Do you know off the top of your head, to the extent one were to concede that the school board represents the community, what's the average participation of the community percentage-wise in actual elections of people to the school board? Of the prospective voters, what percentage actually turns out in a school board election to get an idea of to what extent they arguably represent the sense of the community?
Your Honor, I would imagine that would vary depending upon the controversy of the particular election that's involved.
Well, I'm sure that's the case.
Yes.
I hope it's not like Soviet Russia, where we can always predict the results of the election ahead of time.
Yes, Your Honor. And as in American elections, where if 50% of the people vote, that is their elected representative, and the hope is that that would be a representative body.
No, I understand that, but to the extent there's an argument here that we are to assume that the school board doesn't need to hear from the community on the record about outrage or acquiescence in situations like this, and people like me are asked to rely comfortably on the fact that the school board actually represents the morals of the community, give me some idea why I should just accept that if the school board voter turnout is 15%. As opposed to a general election in November of 2008, where it's all probability going to be 60% or more. Should I be confident that the elected school board really does reflect the moral judgment of the community?
Your Honor, unless it is shown otherwise that they do not, these are generally leaders of the community, people who have given some indication of their ability to make decisions on behalf of the school district.
Well, the apparatchik in Soviet Russia could make decisions, probably technically correct decisions, but that's not the issue. The issue is you're telling us when an almost undefinable term like immorality is to be used, we should be confident that there's no bright line that has to be drawn. There's no fear of adequate notice to employees about what constitutes immorality in the school district. And we should simply rely on the judgment of the school board to make that after the fact, and that they will be correct. They will correctly reflect what people in the community will be worried about to the extent that it creates such a hostile environment that this person should be terminated.
Yes, Your Honor, because of the structure of our government in which school districts are political subdivisions, and in a sense, boards of education are governing bodies that have been entrusted with the authority to determine educational policy for their school districts, courts have traditionally deferred to school districts, to boards of education, to make decisions such as this.
Okay,
yes, Your Honor.
What about notice? Does the term immorality give notice to employees about how to conduct themselves?
Your Honor,
is it just intuitive that this shouldn't go on? Or?
Your Honor, I again respectfully submit, as Justice Jacobs was indicating, that in this case, definitely there was notice that the employee should have known that his conduct was immoral. But in other cases that are perhaps closer to the line, an argument might be made, as in the Molstay case. How would someone have known that this activity, how would the teacher have known that his activity was definitely immoral? But as Judge Graves in the Molstay case and other courts have determined, the interest in ensuring that our teachers are effective role models for children is perhaps greater than the idea that someone would be given specific notice that their particular activity, if it's close to the line, would be considered prohibited. But in this case...
I'm not even talking about an individual being given specific notice, because we probably would agree that you can't get down to specificity, but in every detail. But something more than just the term immoral conduct, which means different things to different people.
And Your Honor, perhaps this is an unsatisfying answer, but I think it has to go to the decisions of courts, as I believe this court has been trying to reach a decision, and even asking for the supplemental memos where we gave many other cases. You have to look at the decisions of courts to determine what have courts in the past determined to be immoral conduct. Where has the line? Where have courts determined that the line has been crossed in the past? But I think one underlying factor, one thread that runs through all of these cases, is that courts have deferred to the judgment of boards of education in general to determine
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 8 minutes, Mr. Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I just want to make a few comments. The comments are, it's always so comfortable for litigators to find brown cow cases, you know, that we're on all fours and we understand what an appellate court has done, and so this is why it should be the same thing. We're at an area where obviously we respectfully submit that the facts are very important in this particular case. As an example, in the Molstay case that was just mentioned, I believe I can make a confident argument that when a special education teacher who has an eighth grade student that he's hugging and kissing in class, that's, I think, a lot different and a lot more uncomfortable to suggest the res ipsa loquitur kind of argument than what we have here. I respectfully submit that we still need to suggest that the conscientious judgment of the school board is not a substitution for some degree of evidence below. In the page 7 of the trial of the reviewing court's decision, it sets out for what I respectfully submit is an appropriate balance here, that a private act with no impact on a teacher's job did not constitute immorality sufficient to justify a termination. That's the Florian case. And that's what we're submitting here, that I'm not conceding the argument, by the way, that it's immoral. I just want you to understand that. I mean, I'm not conceding that point either, but what I'm also suggesting is that there was no evidence below at the hearing that took 20 minutes, that they only called the cop
to the hearing, the cop that testified about what his investigation was, and then we put in his references and things along those lines.
His meaning, your client.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Mr. Leto's status reports and things along those lines. That's what we put in evidence. That was it. It was done. It was 20 minutes. It was over. And there was nothing that suggested whatsoever the pulse of the community other than...
Before we focus on the particular facts of this case, let me just state something and ask if you agree or disagree with it. That there may be conduct which by itself gives rise to reasonable inferences of unfitness to teach or from which an adverse impact on students can reasonably be assumed. Is that true or false?
I think I can generally agree with that, and I can tell you where I would agree with that. Maybe it was your question to me about horrific incidences with an adult and a juvenile student, that might be an easier res ipsa loquitur kind of thing. But I still say that this case is completely different.
All right. Now, if the case can be decided, let's say there's two conclusions that can reasonably be drawn. Does that mean that there is not substantial evidence to support the board's decision?
In my case?
Right.
In my case, I respectfully submit that. That's why I'm here. I'm not even conceding the immorality issue, but I'm also saying that you can't, nobody, the reviewing judge, it was pure supposition about whether or not the recognition of a relationship by others began probably, inevitably, to occur. Ultimately, it spreads to friends and to parents of friends and to the police authorities. Whether prudish or archaic or representative, this was a community reaction. I respectfully submit that prong is not present in our case.
If you were to prevail on your argument here, and if I understand you correctly, what would happen is that there would be a remand to the board where the board would have to hear evidence of the community's perception of your client's conduct. Is that correct?
That may be one opportunity available to us. I mean, but I think there was a hearing that was lacking, and they kept this young man from being employed for the last 2 years almost.
And assuming there were such a second hearing, would it take anything more than simply one parent in the school district showing up and saying, I'm offended and find this inappropriate conduct for a teacher in our schools, and that would do it?
I'm not certain. It would depend upon what the teacher, what the parent would be saying and under what circumstances and how he or she found it out.
In taking the police officer's testimony, did the board learn that the 17-year-old hockey player had told her story to another hockey player who then told it to the mom told her mom, and her mom became the complaining witness, so to speak, for the police officer to catalyze his investigation?
No, I think what they found out was that the hockey player girl found out about it. We don't know how she found out about it.
Well, but she told
her mother. Learned,
she told her mother.
She did.
Why isn't that a factual basis for the reviewing judge's conclusions about it spreading through the community?
Well, it may spread through the community. The problem is something that is hostile to his ability to perform his job.
Okay, so it's not that there are no facts to support what you just read to us, but that the conclusion from those facts is far, too far broad.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.